Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And for this holiday season, yes, I'm so glad you're still Bob Hill.
Jingle bells, jingle. I am too.
Yeah.
I'm used to it.
Yeah. One thing is constant.
Disgustingly so.
Today on the show, we're going to talk with Pat Stone. He's the creativity, I guess, or, well, maybe not. I think the people are the creativity, perhaps, yeah. But I think he's got a pretty heavy dose of creativity himself. But he's behind Green Prints and Weeder's Digest and long been involved in editing gardening magazines, Mother Earth News for one, but now he's doing his own thing, seeing the beauty in gardening through other people's experiences.
Yeah, I heard Pat speak at the Indiana Master Gardeners Conference. I spoke up there with him, and he told stories after dinner that night, and they were just funny and interesting, and he's got a real knack for telling stories, and he gets to the heart of gardening more than how to kill whatever. But
literally the heart
yeah,
of
the
gardening.
Heart of gardening, and he's fun, he's interesting, and he brings his banjo or guitar along and sings songs. So,
So not only does he tell stories, but he also will sing some songs as well. So we'll hear a little bit of that coming up later. Also, Alice McGowan, she and her husband Brian have some advice on growing and overwintering tender plants.
Very interesting. The other book is called Bulbs in the Basement, Geraniums on the Windowsill, How to Grow and Overwinter 165 Tender Plants. And I was reading the book because I've got an old 140-year-old house with a dark basement that's between 35 and 50 degrees all winter. And guess what exactly is needed to overwinter a lot of plants?
I've long been jealous of your real root cellar.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's nice, and but I learned a lot. There's a lot of things I didn't know about overwintering plants. And
But I think what they're out to teach us, too, is that we don't absolutely have to have Bob's 140-year-old root cellar. We can also manage to take cuttings or overwinter other otherwise tender plants that if we left them outside, they would die. So we look forward to learning the ins and outs of overwintering tender plants. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, ironically, this very morning, before we're going to talk to these folks about overwintering plants, I finally dug up my elephant ears and Canis. It was pretty cold. You know,
anything turned to mush yet?
No, and I was lucky. The early December cold snap, you know, got here all of a sudden and stayed. But I do it every year, and I lose some, and sometimes I don't. And I was a little worried because these plants have been through 16 degrees already. And I dug them up. They seem to be fine. So I'm anxious to talk to these folks about exactly what to do now.
Well, you know, we've talked about it, too. Like, often it's not necessarily, unless we have a super-duper-duper cold winter, it's more wet soil sometimes and the drainage issue that gets the bulbs.
So they seem to be fine, so I'm an anxious parent because I've had them for many years, and they're kind of...
So now they're cozy in the root cellar?
They're heritage. Well, they're in the drying out
process. Then they go to the root cellar.
You betcha.
Okay. Gotcha.
How about Wish You Stay? What's up?
I can't remember if I told you this or not, but we have a new deer protection method.
Oh, is it called Andy?
Sort of. It was his idea. You know, just the other day, this little Sweet Bay Magnolia that was, you know, probably 3 feet at the most high. We've been babying it for several years because it's been nibbled on in the past. Walking down the driveway to get the mail, and I hear Andy go, "What?"
Oh, no.
Looks over, and it's just gone.
Uh-oh.
It's just gone. So the deer had one rubbing action, it snapped it right off. So what Andy started to do, and it may not have helped with this particular tree because it was a little smaller, but what he started to do, because we've run out of tomato cages to put around everything, he's using just tree debris, sticks.
Yeah.
And
he
kind of puts them around the...
Like a tent?
Not even like a tent, but just up to like a foot or so around the base.
Okay.
And then it kind of lays them out from the tree. So if the deer tried to get close, it would kind of stumble and trip in the branches.
Make them work.
It doesn't look really pretty. But it seems to be working.
Well, there you go. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, so certain, because the rutting activity seemed to start a bit earlier, and I don't know if it's because it got cold, Bob, but it started a bit earlier, so it caught us off guard.
It's
you know?
Economy, maybe.
Maybe. It's the economy, stupid.
Too.
Yeah, they are. So anyway, you know, so much for the Irish Spring soap bar. We're just going to opt for fallen limbs and create little trap areas.
How big can you go with those things? How high will you stack them up? Is it just your baby plants or some bigger ones?
Pretty much just the smaller trees that, you know, maybe are about a couple inch, you know, an inch to 2 inch.
The more ruddable ones, so to speak?
Exactly. Because some trees just have that profile where the deer want to rut on them.
Oh,
so they're usually, a certain size, relatively small, kind of looks like a big deer antler standing there, and then they want to rub on it. So,
yeah.
For you know, to in simple terms.
Well, but I'll
seems
be watching.
To be work. Okay. Speaking of deer and nature, there's some cool holiday events coming up, Bob. The Louisville Nature Center, you know, over there by the zoo.
Yep.
On Illinois Avenue.
Yep.
Two things. Really, really great idea. Sort of like I can't believe nobody's ever done this before. New Year's Eve.
Uh-huh.
The Louisville Nature Center is having a New Year's Eve lock-in. And, you know, if you're looking for a cool place for your kids to hang out New Year's Eve,
yeah.
They can go to the Louisville Nature Center and they can experience a wide range of nature-related educational things while doing some socializing as they ring in 2009.
Well, good for them.
I would do that, but I'm probably too old to do it.
I'm asleep by 9 o'clock anymore.
Yeah, and it's a lock-in, too, so it starts from 7 p.m., doors lock at 7:30, and then you get picked up the following morning at 10 o'clock. Pretty cool.
Boy,
it's like a slumber party, too.
Somewhat asleep, I would think, by then.
Yeah, we will be for sure.
Yeah.
Prior to that, the Louisville Nature Center is also hosting on December 23rd, first time around, and then again on the 30th, they're having children's holiday, like day camp stuff. So you'll make crafts and learn about additional things. So if you're looking for some cool things for your kids to do while they're out of school during the holidays, check with the Louisville Nature Center. Might be right up your alley.
And they might tell some gardening stories.
They might indeed tell some gardening stories. I bet they will tell some gardening stories.
Yeah, and if you want to hear a gardening story of your own, we've got the perfect guest coming up to tell the tale. His name is Pat Stone. He's from Fairview, North Carolina. He's former editor of the Mother Earth magazine, who decided to kind of go beyond giving gardening tips and to tell plants stories that went to the heart and soul of gardening. He's a very entertaining man. He sings songs. He travels around the country. He's got ballads. He talks about plants. And with Christmas just down the calendar, he's with us today to tell us some plant stories and all about his magazine called Green Prints. Pat, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, thank you, Bob. Good to be here.
Yeah, I heard you speak at the Indiana Master Gardeners Convention. You told some really fun and poignant stories and then sang a few songs for us that were garden-related. It was really a great evening, really. Tell us about, a little background quick, how you got from A to singing songs to Master Gardeners in Indianapolis, Indiana.
I've sort of evolved into being the gardener's storyteller, the gardener's folklorist. And it was kind of roundabout. I used to work at Mother Earth News magazine, where I was the garden editor for 12 years, telling people when to prune their raspberries, how to plant their broccoli. And after doing that about a dozen cycles, I thought, you know, this is good, this is great, but really there's more to gardening than that. We garden for the food and for the flowers, but we also garden for the inner satisfactions and the joys that brings us, and nothing really shares that. So when the time at Mother Earth came to a close, I wanted to start my own garden magazine, and I didn't want to compete with 100 other how-to ones out there. So I started Green Prints, which is a Weeder's Digest. It's a magazine that shares people's personal garden experiences.
So how do you amass the personal gardening experiences?
Well, most everybody who gardens does it for these reasons. There's this satisfaction of it. There's humor. There's frustrations. There's all sorts of things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm really the only magazine that publishes this stuff, I've got the market cornered.
You do indeed.
I get stories from all over the country, sometimes from different parts of the world. I help do Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul, which is, you know, a collection of garden stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of the guy there, the Garrison Keillor of gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you collect these ideas? Now, do people call you? Do you go through other magazines and steal stuff? Or
I'm not adverse to running something that somebody else has run in a book or a magazine. But by and large, people contact me. My name's out there now, and writers from all over the country who, you know, something happens, they want to share it. Where are they going to share it? I am that forum.
Mm-hmm.
I am that outlet for that.
So what are some of the good stories from this year, Pat?
Oh, golly. Well, in the new issue, the winter issue, there's just a beautiful, we'll start with a funny one. A wonderfully funny story about a woman in the Pacific Northwest. She wants to grow a garden that's full of native plants, the kind that grow indigenous to the area, the lichens, the warts, all those things. And she gets all these things planted up, and everything's looking great, but then she realizes something's missing. She needs something else to make it really look like the Northwest, and decides that what's missing is an old stump. That would really look lush and natural.
Right.
So she tries to find one, but you can't find old stumps very easily. And she looks and looks, and finally she finds a construction site where there's one they're going to get rid of. It's perfect. It's big. She gets a friend. They haul. They push. They load. It snags in their hair. It's like an octopus. They finally get it on the property. They're trying to find the right spot for it. A a neighbor, Dave, is watching them all the time, never saying a word. They get it located, they think, oh, no, let's move it a little more to the left. No, no, up to the right some. Slide it a little more towards the center. Oh, grunt, push. There, that's it. Just when they finally get it perfect, and this centerpiece of this garden is located, Dave looks over the fence and says, you know, you're going to have a heck of a time getting that thing to grow.
Actually, Pat, I was thinking the whole time that sounds like something that Bob Hill would in fact do is look for a huge stump and then drag it home so he could grow something on it.
It was a great idea. But
actually, Bob Hill has done that. I got an old locust stump a neighbor drug out with a backhoe. It was neat because I turned it upside down with the roots up in the air.
Mm.
And it's like something out of the Greek tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a neat.
I had a subscriber once who planted his green bean seeds. He'd never planted them before. When the seed heads got pushed out of the ground, he thought he'd planted them upside down. So he went through the whole garden, turned them all back upside down, and left them there with the roots waving in the breeze.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
All right. That one's pretty funny. How about some other ones?
All right. Well, a really tender story that I ran recently, I just love it to death. It was called Flowers Grow in a Garden. It's about a girl who learned about gardening from her father, but learned something bigger as well. Her father had a beautiful, perfect flower garden, everything tidy and right behind a white picket fence they whitewashed every year. It was just, everything was just meticulous. But one day he came home from work, and his wife had picked a bunch of flowers and put them in a vase and a bouquet inside. She'd never done that before. He walked in the kitchen. Are those my flowers? Your flowers? I always thought it was our garden. Now you say they're your flowers? You're darn tootin' they're my flowers, he yelled. I planted them, weeded them, and watered them. You can look at them, but you aren't supposed to pick them. Well, excuse me, Mother said, tears rolling down her face. You just keep your precious flowers. I'll never go into your garden again. She ran to the bedroom, slamming the door. Well, the little girl said, gosh, I need to get out of here. It's too much. She tiptoed out of the house as her father stomped out to the garden and stayed away for well over an hour, hoping she could sneak back in quietly. When she came back into the house, she says, I got the surprise of my life. My mother was sitting on the couch smiling. My father was next to her with his arm around her. When I looked around the room, it was easy to see why she was beaming. Every flat surface in the whole house had a jar of freshly cut flowers. Mm. I remember thinking Father's garden must be pretty bare. My father had finally realized that flowers may be grown in a garden, but they, and love, should never be imprisoned behind a white picket fence.
Mm. Wow.
So many of the musings that you get from other gardeners around the country, are they usually just stories, Pat? You know, a funny story, a poignant story?
That's
or are people creative?
I run some essays.
Okay.
Some thoughtful
so there's
pieces
some
like
creative
that. You know,
writing.
I tried to make a handmade refuge for wildlife. I tried to live a year on locally grown food.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly I run stories because I really think the emotional side of gardening is underneath it all, why we garden.
Mm-hmm.
That relationship and that nurturing of the plants is a loving relationship. And the way to communicate that and to share that is through stories. Stories sort of bypass the whole cognitive brain thing and go straight to our heart. That's what we watch on TV and movies. That's what we read.
Yeah, I guess
stories
so, yeah.
Hit us in our feeling. So one person called this magazine Information for the Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really true. And also you have information also, period. I mean, the winter edition, 2008 and 2009, a story about oranges at Christmas. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's Diana Wells writes me every issue, and she's sort of my garden historian.
Mm-hmm.
And she will write essays that do cover the history of a plant or a vegetable with a little personal touch beside. And having oranges in her stocking when she grew up in Britain was a big thrill. That was a big treat. And now, of course, oranges are everywhere. And she's kind of, in that article, traces the whole history of oranges, their cultivation, and how they got to be so popular.
Mm-hmm.
Another story about a woman at the yard of the month that was kind of a holy grail to her. And when she finally kind of relaxed and let it happen, she got the yard of the month sign.
That was a great story. Bob, you picked up on some good things here.
Well, they're in the book, man.
There you go. That must be why. No, this woman, Sarah Parrott, was a military wife who always had to move. And one year they moved to a spot. She thinks, I'm going to make the best garden. I'm going to win yard of the month. And she spends hundreds of dollars and hours of toil making, lining it with bricks, the whole dump load of dirt, putting all these plants in, 172 bags of mulch. And then they have to move. She's a military wife. And, you know, she's never going to see her yard of the month. Years and years later, after deployment and deployment, 14 years later, she's realizing she's never going to plant that big garden again. She comes back to the same area she lived in, drives down the road. It's full of, sees the garden. It's full of peony blooms and vinca and gardenia, hedges. And everything's growing just great. But the thing that really caught my eye was a sign right smack in the middle of the red, blue, and yellow collection, Yard of the Month. I knew I'd win that award. I just didn't realize how long it'd take.
No kidding. Oh.
That's funny. Then there was a sad one, sad and poignant again, about remembering Orlando.
Oh, yeah, that's a very sweet story.
Tell us about that.
Robert Christensen is one of my regular authors. He generally writes humorous stuff, and he runs a circus in New York State. Huh. But, and this particular piece he sent me was about an old gardener friend who taught him how to grow grapes. He taught him, you know, just cut off everything else, Macko. Just leave two eyes. He gave him all his expertise. He's kind of a cranky guy. Always called him Macko. But then, and he loved him. He learned a lot from him. And then eventually, Macko had to go to a retirement home, and Robert would help him garden there, and they'd have little vegetable plots. But one day, Orlando wasn't there. He'd suffered a stroke. And so Robert went to visit him in the hospital. And tried, you know, cheer him up. Hey, I was there at 9 o'clock sharp. Where are you? Son of a gun, I fire you. Really, Orlando was getting too weak to respond.
Yeah.
And he said he'd put the lettuce seeds, gave to him. He said he'd come back tomorrow. And as he was leaving, the nurse took me aside. Don't get your hopes up too much. Strokes usually come in series. He could have another one. My mind told me to go back and say goodbye. And I went down, sat in the chair beside his bed, and took his hand. He was sleeping. I said, thank you, Orlando. Thank you for all the lessons and all the fun. I learned so much from you. We had a great time. I love you. Now I need to go home. I think maybe it's time for you to go home, too. Goodbye.
Well, yeah.
It's a very sweet story.
A lot of the funnier ones you had was in the atheist section, which sounds anti-Christmas, but tell us some atheist stories.
I hope you'd appreciate that, Bob, because I imagine you get some interesting questions from time to time.
Oh, yeah, we do.
The guy who runs the Master Gardener program in my state, North Carolina, has saved up some of the humorous questions master gardeners have been asked on their hotlines, and he shared them in my magazine. One of them was like, when I moved into my new house, the builder said I should water my new lawn 3 times a day. How long should I continue to do this? The gardener questioned him, how long have you lived there? 7 years. Or somebody asked him, how do you plant bluegrass sod, green side up or green side down? What disease did the peach tree I cut down last year have? And this one, only Southerners can truly appreciate this. I want to grow kudzu. How do I get it started? Well, my favorite one, of course, you have to know what aphids are and be a gardener to know that, yeah, is someone who said, I have atheists on my house plants. How do I get rid of them?
Thus, the atheists in the garden.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Bob was particularly excited after he had heard you speak earlier that you also did some musical numbers as well.
Right.
Somewhat of a collection of performances by some of the contributors in the Green Prints, it seems. Can you talk a little bit about how you moved from print to audio, I guess?
Well, I do a lot of music in my own life.
Okay.
My wife and I actually lead the music in church every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I play mandola, which is kind of mandolin, and she plays guitar, and I've sung a lot of songs to my kids for 20 years, 3 songs every night, and I've done a lot of storytelling, local storytelling and songs. So I started looking for garden songs, and you think about it, we all know inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow, which is a perfectly nice song.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only garden song? It's called The Garden Song? So I started doing research, and I found others, and I actually haven't recorded most of them, but I do perform them when I go around and give talks. And one of them's from the Fantastics. It's called Planet Radish. It's a mm-hmm. great song about growing vegetables and growing children. Growing vegetables is better. What you plant is what you get.
Yeah.
And another one's called True Love and Homegrown Tomatoes, a great country song about there's only two things that money can't buy. That's true love, yeah, and homegrown tomatoes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that song.
So have you written any on your own?
I've sort of adapted a few.
Okay.
According to me, Otis Redding wrote a garden song about weeding, and weeding by the side of the bed. And the Beatles wrote a whole slew of garden songs. I don't need a rototiller. I want to dig by hand. You know, I have a whole collection of Beatles songs.
Well, Pat, what's your future? I know you travel around the country and give talks and take care of green prints. What else do you have in mind? Anything in particular?
My gosh, Bob. I'll tell you one project I'm involved in right now that's not going to make me a cent of money. I'm helping to organize a group of churches in my area to start a food garden for the local food bank.
Yeah, good for you.
We actually broke ground on it last Saturday. It's going to be the kind of vegetable garden where a certain percentage of everything we grow goes straight to the food pantry, which is, you know, their needs are increasing every year right now.
Right, even more so, huh?
And the other percentage goes to the people who work there. We're going to encourage anybody who wants to learn how to garden and help grow some of their own produce to do it there. So a lot of the people who go to the food bank, they could actually garden there and help earn the food they eat. And that, we call it the Lord's Acre. That's the project I'm kind of putting my teeth into right now.
That's really neat. Well, Pat, thanks. It's always good to talk to you and listen to you and hear your songs, and hope to see you again somewhere down the road.
Absolutely. I do hope you'll tell people how they can get this magazine.
I'll tell them right now.
Thank you very
much. All right,
gang. Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Pat Stone is editor of Green Prints magazine and a songwriter par excellence, including The 12 Days of Gardening. For more information on Pat or how to subscribe to Green Prints, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
After the break, bulbs in the basement and geraniums on the windowsill. We are overwintering the garden indoors with Alice McGowan. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
On the first day we gardened, my true love said to me,
I've planted an evergreen tree. On the second day we gardened, my true love said to me,
I think I overwatered,
but I planted an evergreen tree.
On the third day we gardened, my true love said to me,
uh-oh, it's raining. Think I overwatered, but I planted an evergreen tree. On the fourth day we gardened, my true love said to me,
where did that goat come from?
Uh-oh, it's raining, think I overwatered, but I planted an evergreen tree.
On the fifth day we gardened, my true love said to me,
I hope it lives. Where did that goat come from? Uh-oh, it's raining, think I overwatered, but I planted an evergreen tree. On the sixth day we gardened, my true love said to me,
I think the trunk is healing.
I hope it lives. Where did that goat come from? Uh-oh, it's raining, think I overwatered, but I planted an evergreen tree.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob
Hill.
And you're?
Janine Wishy.
I was just trying to remember.
I thought I was losing him there.
Just testing you.
I think he forgot who he was. Yes, Bob Hill and Janine Wishy here.
We are.
This, going back to what you were bragging about earlier.
I was just telling
your
the facts.
Root cellar.
Okay, I was bragging.
So, have you ever wondered how you can maximize these interesting spaces you have at home to overwinter plants or to propagate plants even?
Yes,
you
yes,
know?
And yes.
And people have asked, you know, bringing in geraniums, coleus, all kinds of things. And there's various techniques and methods to consider when you are trying to propagate or overwinter plants. And we are presenting you with some more detail. Not Bob and I, but actually our guest today. Her name is Alice McGowan. She and her husband, Brian, are the authors of Bulbs in the Basement, Geraniums on the Windowsill, How to Grow and Overwinter 165 Tender Plants. The McGowans operated Blue Meadow Farm in Montague, Massachusetts for about 18 years. Now they live in overwinter plants in their basement and elsewhere, I'm sure,
yeah.
At their home in Cape Cod. Alice, welcome to Homegrown and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Sure. Listen, tell us a little bit about how you and your husband, Brian, first got involved in the business in Blue Meadow Farm.
Well, many years ago, we were actually growing wholesale vegetables mm-hmm. and Hythe bush blueberries. And we'd always enjoyed gardening with flowers as well as vegetables. And we wanted to try growing flowers, but it seemed like so many other people were growing them that we were a little hesitant. So we started slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And our first season, we sold 6 packs out under a tent by the side of the very quiet road that our farm was located on.
Uh-huh.
And that was really the beginning. We had a much better season that first year than we'd ever imagined we would.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kept going.
Kind of led to you all, I guess, gaining a reputation somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
At Blue Meadow Farm. Can you talk a little bit about what the specialty was and, you know, honestly, how it led to the book, Bulbs in the Basement, Geraniums on the Windowsill, that experience overwintering growing tender plants?
Mm-hmm. Partly because we were located on such a quiet, out-of-the-way backcountry road, we figured out that it made a lot of sense to grow plants that other people weren't growing.
Yeah.
And
right.
We were interested ourselves in unusual plants, and so the more we grew, the more we studied in the winter and found out about plants that we hadn't tried before. We learned from our customers a lot of the time, especially older gardeners who were looking for plants they couldn't find anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, you know, through a combination of our own research and the help of veteran gardeners, we found all kinds of oddball things, and we tried them.
Mm-hmm.
And we found, you know, that we could interest our customers in them. We had a large display garden, so we planted things there that they could see. A lot of the tender perennials that we were growing needed to be kept over the winter, and that was, you know, we learned through our own experience how to make that work.
Mm-hmm.
Alice, let's talk about that. The tender perennials and the new word these days, the temperennials,
mm-hmm.
something
right.
like that. What makes the cut in your book? Is it 32 degrees and you're dead, or how do you decide what's a tender perennial and plant for
well,
your basement?
Well, the definition of a tender perennial is really just a perennial plant that is not hardy in the zone the gardener is growing it.
Okay.
And so, you know, depending on what part of the world the gardener's in.
Yeah.
Right.
That,
a tender
that,
perennial
that,
to
that,
you
that
may be. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the mentality, if you will, the setup, what one would need to prepare for and expect if they do want to winter over or, you know, propagate some of these tender plants. There's considerations like moisture, like temperature, what kind of space you have. You know, talk about the different realities that some people are going to have and what we can do in those spaces.
Well, in a general way, most indoor living spaces tend to be too warm and too dry for the majority of plants. Plants, though, that are happy in those conditions include succulents and cacti. Certainly begonias do very well. There are a lot of plants that can handle those conditions as long as you're aware of the fact that that might not be ideal.
Yeah.
But the cool basement, of course, is something most gardeners wish they had, and it's a hard thing to approximate because in a cool basement you can encourage a plant to stay dormant all winter. You don't have to water it a lot. You don't have to fertilize it a lot. It can basically sit in its pot and,
mm-hmm.
and just wait until conditions change. And the humidity in a cool basement is also perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There are groups of tender perennials, though, that are happy in conditions that might really surprise most gardeners, like the corms and tubers that we list in our book that you can actually just store in a paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
There are others that you can just leave in a pot and put in a dark place. I think as I wrote the book, it really seemed to me that almost anybody can store some tender perennial. One of the things our book tries to help the reader come to grips with is what plants can you realistically store in the space you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I liked about your book, and I mean this as a complete compliment, is there's a lot of plants here I never heard of,
uh-huh.
only because I never realized I could overwinter them. Really beautiful foliage plants that people ought to try and have been afraid to do it.
That's right, yeah. Once you think of it as something that you can keep from season to season. Not quite such an intimidating investment.
You don't mind spending the money.
Yeah.
And then one other thing, you mentioned my basement is just dark all winter pretty much. And you mentioned there are some plants you can just bring in, stick in the dark, and bring them up again in April.
That's right.
What are some of those you had the best luck with?
Well, some of the most reliable, we have a plant called Syningia, which is actually in the same family as African violets.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that we just leave out for a light frost, and after that it comes inside. It doesn't get watered. It just sits in its pot in a corner. And in the spring, when things start warming up enough that you don't have to worry about the threat of frost, you can bring it outside, start watering it lightly, and it does resprout.
So, Alice, do you, most of these plants that are, you know, moving to and fro, do you typically keep them in containers, or are you also digging and lifting and transplanting, that sort of thing, to bring them indoors? Or is it, you know, advisable to stick with the containers?
I'd say it does depend on the plant. Okay. Some of them are definitely easiest to handle in a container, but then there are other things that you're going to want to dig up, certainly tubers and corms. Often, if they're planted into a bed out in the garden,
they need to be lifted.
You're going to want to dig them up.
Uh-huh. So, is it advisable then, if we kind of reflect on what we've been talking about thus far, is it advisable if you can to sort of let the plant go into somewhat of a dormant stage unless you have this ideal sort of growing environment indoors? And how do we, I guess, encourage the dormancy, but still also maintain the life of the plant while it sleeps?
Right. Well, you do have a basic choice, taking into account your storage conditions and the needs of the plant, whether you're going to encourage dormancy or not. I mean, often if a plant is winter blooming or if the foliage maintains some interest during the winter, you might not want it to be dormant because you might want to be able to look at it. But if it is going to be something that you are just storing in a cool or dark environment and you aren't encouraging growth, the best way to encourage dormancy usually is with cool temperatures and fairly dry growing conditions.
Okay, and just sort of
it does vary with the individual plant, but yeah, we try to be pretty specific.
Yeah.
I've had mixed results with the old-fashioned, the cannas and the calocasias and allocasias, the elephant ears. Some winters seem to be better than others. What is the secret to keeping those alive over the winter?
Well, you know, I'm at this point going to hand you over to Brian, who can tell you.
Okay. Alice's husband, Brian McGowan.
Waiting in the wings.
Her partner in crime.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Brian.
Brian.
How are you?
We're good. So Bob was asking desperately how to...
Well, guiltily. I just dug them up here. It was 16 degrees. I finally got my cannas and allocasias and calocasias dug up just this morning, and I've had mixed results over the years keeping them alive. So what's the trick to that?
We used to do it pretty simply by, waiting until a frost had killed the leaves back, cut the leaves and the stems, the flower stems back, dig the cannas up, and try to keep them as whole as possible before you store them. Don't try to divide them in the fall, although sometimes that's hard because they grow so quickly and they can get so large that in order to store them, you have to dig them up. You have to divide them somewhat. Shake a fair bit of the soil off, and then we would just put them in a big plastic garbage bags, actually the kind that contractors use that you can get at the hardware store that are larger than a normal garbage bag and much heavier plastic so they don't tear. Actually, when you put it in there, you don't want the soil to be wet. You just want the soil to be damp. So if the soil, if you have clay soil especially, and the soil is really wet after you dig, let the soil dry out a bit and then put it in the bag. You can close the top of the bag. Then the most important thing is probably to put it in as cool a place as you can that's above freezing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another plant in your book that I've always wanted to try because I love the foliage so much is the giant rhubarb or the gunnera.
Oh, yeah.
And, it's 6 foot by 6 foot leaves. I just go nuts when I see it in tropical gardens or in different horticulture places. But can the average person grow that and store those plants?
You can do it. If you have a space, if you have space to do it and keep the pot, a large pot, we used to grow them in large pots, pots that were maybe 2 feet across on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And we could grow a gunnera in that pot for maybe 3 years before it got too big for the pot. And in that size of a pot, you could actually grow a pretty impressive gunnera, you know, that had wonderful foliage and leaves. And in the winter, in the fall, the leaves of the gunnera will die back. So all you're left with for the winter is this giant bud.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty impressive. It's probably the biggest bud of anything that I think I've ever seen. So that what you need to find the space for is that pot. And that's where having some kind of a root cellar that you can just drop that pot into is ideal.
Bingo.
There, it's no problem.
So Brian, I got to ask, just for those sort of standard plants that people really want to get wintered over and they're not always entirely sure what to do, the banana, you know, people have a love affair with their bananas. So what's the easy wintering over technique for the banana?
Well, probably the easiest one is to pick a variety that's the hardiest.
That's the first step, right?
Yeah, there's a hardy banana called Musa Baju,
mm-hmm.
and that banana is actually hardy in the ground in where we live. So it would certainly be hardy in Kentucky.
Right.
The problem with overwintering a banana is, and it's a real catch-22, is that you can't really cut it back. So it's going to grow a stem, and if you want to keep letting it grow and get large and beautiful, mm-hmm. you have to have a tall enough ceiling and a big enough space to bring it.
Mm-hmm. So it's best just to kind of cut it back and throw it in the basement and let it go dormant?
That's right. If you mm-hmm. cut it back, you're going to lose that growth, and then you're just going to be getting new growth every year from mm-hmm. the pups that come off the side.
So are there some plants that are best just sort of take some cuttings, you know, before a hard freeze and, like, let the plant die outside and just start anew every year? So,
yeah,
you know.
Definitely. A lot of plants are plants that grow very quickly, because I think the thing you want to think of when you're overwintering your plants is you want to be careful which ones you choose. And I would suggest people choose things that are hard to find out in the trade or that might be expensive, or things that you really just don't want to, you're afraid that you won't be able to find it again.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of those plants, and also plants that take a while to develop into a size, because there's lots of plants that if you keep the plant for 2 or 3 years, it just develops so much more and has so much more of a potential in your garden to be a stunning plant
mm-hmm.
that, you know, like certain salvias are that way, that they're kind of woody and they're almost shrubs. So it's really worth it to keep certain plants for 2 or 3 years to let them develop structure. So certain plants, like coleus is a great example of a plant that is much better just to take a cutting and maybe take a number of cuttings and grow it on your windowsill for the winter.
Mm-hmm. Is there a standard technique for people, you know, real straightforward, to take those cuttings, get them rooted out, and ready to go for spring?
The simplest is basically the good old-fashioned way of take the cutting, especially when it's something that roots as easily as coleus,
mm-hmm.
you just take it and root it in water.
Okay.
And, you know, everybody seems to know how to do that, and it's not very intimidating. You run into problems with water when it takes a long time for plants to root, and they sometimes rot. And after the plant roots, you really should get it out of the water and get it into a little container so
okay.
you don't have root rot problems.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the least intimidating way to go about it, and mm-hmm. just get your fingers, you know, kind of wet and green at the same time.
Yeah.
And get some plants growing. It's real rewarding. And other plants that are pretty rewarding and simple to root are the more succulent salvias. Salvias that don't have woody stems, but salvias that have a more succulent stem on them, more herbaceous salvias. Some of those, the one, I don't know if you're familiar with indigo spires.
Yes.
That salvia just will root in a matter of days when the conditions are right, when it's warm. And so it's, I always suggest people get their kids to root that because it's just so, it's almost a sure bet.
Okay, good.
And it's so rewarding to start rooting plants and realize that, oh, I can do this. And, you know, and it's, I think it's just such a sensible gardening skill.
And even more so today, as people start to sort of tighten their budgets up with other in other areas, they can have a little more fun starting their own plants.
That's
while
right.
Saving some money.
And when you overwinter some of these plants then that you're going to bring back out, you could, in the early spring, you could actually start taking cuttings from those plants and, you know, greatly increase the number of plants that you have to put in the garden for very little or almost no money.
So, yeah, that's the best thing about your book, really. Janine and I talk all the time about pushing the envelope and trying new things, and this book encourages people to do that, to try plants we've never heard of, frankly, that you can buy and keep and bring them back every year.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And there's so many unused plants out there, and a lot of times there's really no good reason why they're not used. Mm-hmm. You know? So it's kind of fun to encourage people to do that and see what happens.
Yeah, Brian, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Janine.
Brian McGowan and his wife Alice are the authors of Bulbs in the Basement, Geraniums on the Windowsill, How to Grow and Overwinter 165 Tender Plants, published by Story Publishing. The McGowans operated Blue Meadow Farm in Montague, Massachusetts for 18 years, and now they live in overwinter plants at their home in Cape Cod. Of course, for more information, you can visit our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a listener question and Miss Wishy's new, short, to the point, ground level, Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill with a question for Miss Wishy.
Oh, was it for me today?
Again.
Okay.
You may have noticed there's a pattern forming here.
He assesses the questions to see if there's something dump on me.
It was May or June I answered the question. Come on.
There are some questions that have your name written all over them, and there are some that have mine.
This one, and to that end, this is the two things near and dear to your heart.
Uh-oh.
Southern Indiana.
Yeah.
And a herb called cumin.
Cumin. And I do like cumin.
Here's the third part of this thing. It's from a woman named Branch.
All right.
What better for a gardening show than
could
a question
be a man, though.
About Southern Indiana? Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
That's true. I'm leaping to conclusions here.
You
anyway,
are.
Here's the question from either Mr. or Mrs. Branch. Can cumin be grown in Southern Indiana? If so, can I use the whole cumin seeds from a spice bottle for planting if I can't find the plantable seeds?
Hmm. Yes, maybe.
Maybe question.
I can tell you where you
next
can find
question.
Them.
Yes.
Okay, yes. Cumin's a fabulous spice. So the seeds are ground up to make the spice, right?
Okay.
Cumin, like people put cumin in their chili. It's usually part one of the spices that's part of a chili mix.
Oh, yeah.
I use a lot of cumin in Indian, Southeast Asian, Indian cuisine, you know, that sort of thing. Really, really nice spice to use. Particularly this time of the year, I think it's just got that warm sort of wintertime stew spice to it.
It's kind of like cumin, get it.
Exactly like that.
Holidays, that's what I thought.
So we can, in fact, grow cumin plants in southern Indiana or northern Kentucky, but cumin here is going to be a tender, you know, plant. It's going to be an annual plant, so you'll grow it like you would basil. And, of course, the ideal thing is to, you know, get it out as a plant early in the season, and then harvest, you know, let the seed ripen and harvest the seed so you have that spice part, not just the leafy herb part. I can't tell you for sure if you would be able to get whole seed from a spice bottle to germinate. I would suspect you would have poor germination from that source. What I would do instead is either order the seeds from a catalog, or better yet, go buy the plants in the spring of the year. You know, almost certainly Thienemann's Herbs and Perennials would have the plant. Almost certainly Cheryl in Southern Indiana.
Cheryl Gilbert, Old House,
Old Time Log House Nursery. She specializes in herbs as well.
Yeah, Otisco, she'd have it for sure.
Otisco, yeah. So she'd have it for sure. So I would look for the plant in the spring of the year because it is going to be an annual plant, so you're not going to find it, you know, sitting around at this point. So
excellent.
Excellent. There we go. All right. If you have a question, you can get a hold of us in a great many different ways. Right, Bob?
Yep. If you have a question for Bob especially, and give Janina, give Janina a week
off.
Pick
out something that has his name all over
it. Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org. Call us at 814-8246, or time is mighty short for the Christmas card. Stick a letter or question on a Christmas card and address it to Bob Hill, care of Homegrown, and we'll give Janine the rest of the year off.
Okay. The rest of 2008 off.
Right.
All right.
Well, Miss Wishy, the Latin word of the week, again, fits exactly what we're talking about. It also reminds me of the thing I used to polish my car.
Yeah. A chamois cloth.
Chamois cloth, yeah.
I wonder the relationship is. But, in fact, that's spelled differently.
It is.
It's French.
Oui, mais oui.
Chamois.
Mais oui, mademoiselle.
The Latin word of the week this week, in fact, is Greek. How's that? And it's in honor of all the elves that are hard at work right now.
Betcha.
This Greek word is... it's like chamois, but it's not. It's when it's Greek, C-H is K, cami.
Cami.
So it's a Greek, it's a prefix that indicates dwarf, indicating dwarfness or low growth in honor of the elves.
I had no idea.
Okay, so it comes from chamois, or camay, I should say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Comes from camay, which means on the ground.
I'll be darned.
That's Greek for on the ground.
All these years I did not know that.
I did not either, and I thought that you would appreciate this because we know this word is a prefix, and especially, I would say, camassiparis.
I love it.
False cypress.
Yeah.
You know, the mop head.
Oh, yeah.
People are probably really familiar with the false cypress, but it's also called
the gold.
Golden mop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very kind of moppy looking, but false cypress. Camassiparis. Representing the cama part, representing the fact that it is, low to the ground, dwarf quality.
It's
exactly.
A jockey's plant.
It is. Camabacia.
That's a dwarf bramble.
A dwarf bramble.
Yeah.
Camabuxus.
With box-like leaves and dwarf creeping habit.
Mm-hmm. So box meaning boxwood. Buxus is boxwood. So
a low-growing boxwood.
Camabuxus. Camaserius.
A cactus with a creeping habit.
Uh-huh.
I got to find one of them.
Yeah. Well, like, the night-blooming cirrus?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Camassiris. So it's in that cactus family.
Yeah.
A little bit different, though. Camadaphne.
The creeping daphne or laurel, also known as Cassandra.
Yeah. Haven't you heard of Cassandra? The referred to as Cassandra.
I love that.
That's a Camadaphne.
What a great name for a plant.
So a low, creeping, daphne-like plant. Camadoria.
A palm with shiny, bright fruit that are easy to get to as they're low to the ground.
Easy to get to. Guess what Doria means in Greek?
Gift. Christmas.
Christmas. But it's a gift because the palm has shiny, bright fruit that are easy to get to.
True.
So they sort of see that as the gift.
And that's a full service.
That's pretty cool, isn't
it?
All right. Camelirium.
The devil's bit.
Devil's bit or
blazing star. Sure.
Camelirium. Lirium is the Greek for lily, so dwarf lily.
Yeah.
Camerops.
The dwarf fan palm.
Dwarf fan palm. Pretty
Boy,
cool, huh?
It's a short list of great plants.
It is a short, it's a long short list.
Yeah.
So, cama, it's a Greek prefix indicating dwarfness or low growth. So, if you see something that begins with cama, C-H, know that it's K, because it's Greek, C-H, it's going to be low, which, sometimes is relative, right?
I'll never forget.
All right, I won't either. That's a good one.
Yeah.
All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, a visit to Biltmore Estates in North Carolina.
Homegrown is produced through the giant talents of Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy, and thanks to Brian Kahn for today as well. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.